reaction in Kyiv following the Trump-Zelensky Oval Office meeting.
I should say that Ukrainians feel that they have been through a lot at this point. And
more roadblocks to a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas.
On Sunday, Netanyahu demanded Hamas release the hostages, threatening what he said were additional consequences without giving further details.
And a look at the aftermath of deadly airstrikes in Darfur.
It was the Army's Air Force. They didn't intend to kill my son, but because the rapid support forces were in the area, he was killed by accident while he was playing with other children. The body was in a bad state, so we had to make sure his siblings didn't see him.
Today is Monday, February 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish. This past Friday in Washington, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky met with U.S. President Donald Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance in the Oval Office. What was supposed to be a meeting to put the final touches on a deal in which Ukraine would give the U.S. access to rare earth mineral reserves in exchange for security guarantees turned sour as the Americans berated Zelensky, telling him he wasn't grateful enough and that he needed America's help.
You don't have the cards right now. You're gambling with the lives of millions of people. You're gambling with World War III.
Trump warned Zelensky to sign a deal that would allow the U.S. to access those rare earth minerals in exchange for support in Ukraine's war against Russia's invasion.
But you're either going to make a deal or we're out.
In a statement on social media following the meeting, Trump wrote that the proposed deal is off. He said Zelensky disrespected the Oval Office and, quote, is not ready for peace. Zelensky left the White House Friday afternoon without a deal. A scheduled news conference was canceled. The world was shocked. Zelensky flew from Washington to London, where European leaders met Sunday to discuss the Russian invasion of Ukraine and European security. And there, Zelensky received a warm welcome. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more.
World leaders gathered in London Sunday for a summit to discuss the future of Ukraine's war with Russia. 3 years into the bloody conflict, leaders at a roundtable discussion told Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky he would have their continued support. The warm welcome in Europe stood in contrast to U.S. President Donald Trump's heated exchange with Zelensky in the Oval Office during his visit last week. Ukraine's president was there to sign a rare earth mineral deal with the U.S., but things took a turn in front of news cameras.
But you're either going to make a deal or we're out. And if we're out, you'll fight it out. I don't think it's going to be pretty, but you'll fight it out. But you don't have the cards. But once we sign that deal, you're in a much better position. But you're not acting at all thankful. And that's not a nice thing.
Trump's top diplomat repeated the president's position Sunday that Zelensky risks World War III by continuing to fight. Adding an end to this war comes through mediation and not on the battlefield.
I'm saying it's 0% likely if we don't get them to a negotiating table. And the sooner everyone grows up around here and figures out that this is a bad war that's heading in a bad direction with death and destruction and all kinds of danger surrounding it that could spiral into a broader conflict, the sooner people grow up and realize that, I think the more progress we're going to be able to make.
Meanwhile, Ukrainian soldiers severely wounded and with amputated body parts returned to combat. They joined what Zelensky describes as 380,000 Ukrainians wounded in the war. Democrats in the United States Congress say this is the wrong time to abandon an ally. Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar speaking Sunday on ABC's This Week.
The soldiers that I just saw last weekend from Ukraine who were getting medical help with hook arms trying to stand up for the Ukrainian national anthem with one leg, you know, this is not the time for us to undermine these brave Ukrainians.
And as the wounded population of Ukraine grows, so too do calls for peace talks. British Ambassador to the U.S. Lord Peter Mandelson speaking Sunday on ABC's This Week.
We have to give peace a chance. We have to give to create the circumstances in which enough pressure is brought on Putin, on Russia, to bring them, to coax them, to force them to the negotiating table. But if it goes wrong, we must be there on Ukraine's side.
for the Ukrainian soldiers, some badly injured, still staffing the front lines, a peace deal may not come soon enough. Arash Erbasadi, VOA News.
For a look at how the people in Ukraine have been handling the ups and downs of the past few days, I'm joined by our Kyiv correspondent, Anna Chernikova. On Friday, of course, President Zelensky was in Washington. He met with President Trump, Vice President J.D. Vance, and by now, I think the world knows what happened at that meeting. What's it like in Ukraine since that happened?
Of course, Ukrainian nation is scared because there is definitely a fear that Ukraine cannot survive this struggle, this fight with Russia without U.S. support. And there is big fear here that U.S. support could actually stop. I'm talking about military support mainly. Because we are seeing other cuts of aid. Also, people hope that this could be kind of, you know, stabilized. So everyone is basically waiting for what's going to happen next for communication between Trump administration and European leaders. So everyone is hoping that this could actually get settled. Maybe not as it was before, but at least to keep this cooperation and to keep this partnership alive.
After Friday, President Zelensky went to London, where he got a much happier reception. Can you tell us about his trip to London? I understand he visited the King today.
President Zelensky left Washington straight to London, where he met with Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister of the UK, and with other European leaders who came on Sunday for security summit that was organized by the UK side. And basically, this summit was about creating a certain new form of European security where Ukraine would be an equal part. So Ukraine received new military support packages and from different countries and also a lot of support in terms of the future. What is important to say that European leaders actually started to discuss this new form of collective security, which might be a certain, you know, a fresh breath into the whole European security situation right now. And after the summit, President Zelensky had a meeting with the King, Charles III. We do not have really much details, but it was a meeting of support for the Ukrainian nation and Ukrainian people.
So, following the emotional roller coaster of the Washington meeting and then the London meeting, would you say Ukrainians are optimistic for the future?
I should say that Ukrainians feel that they have been through a lot at this point, and they still survived after 3 years of full-scale invasion, and they just believe in the best scenario for Ukraine, and they just have, you know, no other decisions than to continue to fight. And I think that without optimism, Ukrainian nation wouldn't survive all these 3 years. So I would say yes, Ukrainians are optimistic, but they are also realistic, and they understand that the tough times come.
VOA's Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Anna, as always, thanks for your time. Thanks for your reporting.
Thank you, Steve.
Looking now at how the meeting was received in the U.S., my next guest wrote that the Trump-Zelensky meeting in the White House was like a Rorschach test. You see what you want to see. Trump's supporters saw strength. Trump's critics saw hostility. Eli Lake writes for the Free Press.
Depending on where you're coming from in the political spectrum right now, you know, is whether you viewed this as the president of Ukraine insulting the United States in an Oval Office meeting, or whether I think there are a lot of Republicans as well, by the way, but if you think it's important that the United States stands by a besieged ally, then you viewed the meeting as J.D. Vance, the vice president, in particular, baiting Zelensky and trying to kind of create this international incident. That's what I meant by that.
So, as you point out, people with different backgrounds and opinions are likely to see different things. But I think one thing everyone can agree on is that we'd never seen anything like this before. How does Friday's meeting change things going forward?
Well, it severely weakens the position of Ukraine. I mean, Ukraine has fought valiantly against a war of conquest by Russia, and it's done so because its most important ally has been the United States. And if the United States is now threatening the president, saying, if you don't want to make a deal, then I'm out. And that deal so far looks like it would be a pretty bad deal for Ukraine. And in that respect, I think the implication is that this is a very vulnerable time right now for Ukraine. It's true that Zelensky has tried to rally his European allies against Russia at this point, and that's important. But I don't, you know, in order for the Europeans to fill the gap, they're going to need a crash program and spend far more money on their defense industrial base. And that's a process that, even in the best case scenario, is probably going to take 2 or 3 years. What's going to happen in this period if Trump makes good on his threats? I think what he did is extremely provocative, and I think that that's a real danger right now. And by the way, if it turns out that as a result of this diplomacy, if that's what you want to call it, with Ukraine, is that Putin then, you know, kind of pushes and tries to swallow Ukraine entirely and tries to take advantage of his window right now, I don't know if that's going to be good politics or if that's going to be a success for the Trump administration. I think it's going to be seen as a failure by the American people.
Well, that brings up my next question is, regardless of Ukraine, if this is the kind of diplomacy that the Trump administration is practicing, what other changes can we see in the world? How would this go on during other negotiations we see?
Well, I would say that Trump clearly believes in a view of an international system that is not based on rules of the road or big. It's basically big powers are allowed to do what they want in their own neighborhoods. And that is sadly how the international system is organized for most of human history. And that it might be true that the sort of American-led order that emerged after World War II and was sort of solidified after the victory in the Cold War is coming to a close. This is an epoch that is ending at this point. So this may be the sunset of America kind of leading the free world, which is a sad thing for those of us who thought that was good for the world and good for America.
Well, if this is the sunset, what's next?
Well, what's next is you will have regional powers like China and Russia, maybe Iran, doing as they wish. We'll get back to a system of vassal states and large countries, and it'll look a lot like the map of the 19th century or, you know, the sort of pre-World War I world. You know, the United Nations, which was not particularly relevant, has not been relevant for decades, will be even less relevant. You're going to see, you know, Russian domination of its neighbors, Chinese domination of its neighbors, and American domination of the Western Hemisphere, and that is going to be the new world.
So would a result like that be a Rorschach test as well? Are there people who would think that's a good thing?
Well, the people who would like to welcome this new era, careful what you wish for, because usually that leads to war. That leads to all kinds of things that aren't good. And I kind of feel like you don't know what you got until it's gone. Is that the Joni Mitchell line? That's a little bit like where I think we're headed now. Maybe it'll be a Rorschach test in the moment. People feel really, you know, Trump and Vance fans will feel really good about this. They feel like they, you know, they had a viral moment. But I think it's a sugar high. I think that, you know, we're going to wake up and we're going to see a very different world. And we're going to see a lot of horror in Ukraine if Putin, you know, decides to move on the green light, so to speak.
Eli Lake is a Washington-based writer for the Free Press. Mr. Lake, thanks for your time. Thanks for your analysis today. Thanks for talking with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Our other top story of the day is in the Middle East. Israel's faced sharp criticism on Sunday after it stopped the entry of all food and other supplies into Gaza and warned of additional consequences if Hamas doesn't accept a new proposal to extend a fragile ceasefire. Reuters' Diane Toh has more.
Aid trucks were stuck in a long line at Egypt's Rafah border crossing on Sunday after Israel blocked them from going into Gaza as a standoff over a truce with Hamas escalated. The first phase of the previously agreed ceasefire expired on Saturday, and talks for a second phase have yet to begin. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told a cabinet meeting on Sunday the country has agreed to a U.S. proposal for a temporary ceasefire in Gaza. The truce proposes to halt fighting until after the Muslim Ramadan holy month and the Jewish Passover holiday, ending around April 20th. Ramadan began on Saturday with thousands of Palestinians seen sitting together between piles of rubble in Gaza for the first break of their daily fast in the evening. The proposed truce requires Hamas to release half of the living and dead hostages on the first day. The remainder are to be released at the end if a deal is reached on a permanent ceasefire. But Hamas has rejected the idea of a temporary extension and called on mediators Egypt and Qatar to intervene. It said it was committed to the originally agreed ceasefire, with second phase talks aimed at a permanent end to the war. On Sunday, Netanyahu demanded Hamas release the hostages, threatening what he said were additional consequences, without giving further details. In response to the rising tensions, Egypt's foreign minister called the use of aid as a weapon of collective punishment a flagrant violation of international humanitarian law. Badr Abdeletti also said the country was continuing intensive efforts to start the second phase talks. At a press briefing, Abdeletti said Egypt has a Gaza reconstruction plan ready to be presented at an emergency Arab summit in Cairo on Tuesday. It comes after Arab states firmly rejected President Donald Trump's plan for the U.S. to take control of Gaza and resettle Palestinians. Abdeletti said he could not give details yet, but that the Egyptian plan will ensure Palestinians remain in their land.
That's Diane Toe of Reuters reporting. And here are some other stories we're following from around the world. An American aircraft carrier arrived in South Korea on Sunday in a show of force just days after North Korea test-launched cruise missiles to demonstrate its counterattack capabilities. The South Korean Navy said that the arrival of the carrier and its strike group at the South Korean port of Busan was meant to display a solid U.S.-South Korea military alliance in the face of persistent North Korean threats. Pope Francis remained in stable condition and didn't need any mechanical ventilation on Sunday, the Vatican said. Doctors in their late Sunday update said his prognosis remains guarded, meaning he isn't out of danger. Taliban officials have denied President Trump's recent assertions that China holds control over a crucial former U.S. military base in Afghanistan. The sprawling Bagram Air Base, situated about 44 kilometers north of the capital, Kabul, served as the central command center for the 20-year U.S.-led military campaign in the country until all U.S. and NATO troops withdrew in August of 2021. Trump claimed during his election campaign speeches that Bagram was under the control of China's People's Liberation Army, and he reiterated that claim before his first cabinet meeting last Wednesday. Taliban spokesperson Zabulah Mujahid told the official broadcaster that the Taliban controls the base and that Chinese troops are not present in Afghanistan. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish. Back now in the United States, the need to end wars in Ukraine and the Middle East, the United States imposing tariffs on other countries, and the downsizing of the U.S. federal government. Those are just some of the topics President Trump is expected to highlight when he delivers the first speech of his second term to Congress later this week. VOA's Veronica Balderas-Iglesias reports.
As he did back in 2017, U.S. President Donald Trump is scheduled to address a joint session of Congress on Tuesday. The Russia-Ukraine war is expected to feature prominently in Trump's speech in the context of his administration's ongoing efforts to mediate peace negotiations between the parties in conflict.
I'm looking for peace. We're not looking to go into a 10-year war and play games. We want peace.
The U.S. leader could also update Congress on his stance on the Israel-Hamas war and the future of Gaza. During a joint press conference with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on February 4th, Trump suggested the U.S. transform Gaza into the, quote, Riviera of the Middle East.
The United States owning that piece of land, developing and creating thousands of jobs with something that will be magnificent.
During his speech at the Capitol, analysts also expect that Trump will speak about the rationale behind the U.S. imposing tariffs on other countries. Trump could also push back on some criticism his administration has received over the speed and scope of its efforts to reduce government spending, cut fraud and waste, and slash the size of the federal workforce. Analyst Shannon Beau O'Brien via Zoom.
I think he's going to talk about it as a cost-saving measure. I believe he's going to talk about how great of a thing it is.
U.S. Senator Elisa Slotkin, a former CIA analyst, has been chosen to give the Democratic rebuttal to President Trump's address. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
And finally today, airstrikes in Sudan, particularly in Darfur, have intensified, causing widespread civilian casualties. From Adre, Chad, Henry Wilkins shares the story of Khadija. She's a refugee who lost her son to one of those aerial attacks in the ongoing civil war between the Sudanese armed forces and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces.
This video, which VOA has been unable to independently verify, purports to show the aftermath of an airstrike. A Darfuri advocacy group says it took place January 21st in the city of Nyala in Sudan's Darfur region. Bodies of babies and children have been strewn about, while what appear to be civilians lie bleeding on the floor. Khadija, who requested her identity be protected for fear of retribution, said she experienced a similar airstrike just days before she was interviewed for this story.
It was the Army's Air Force. They didn't intend to kill my son, but because the Rapid Support Forces were in the area, he was killed by accident while he was playing with other children. The body was in a bad state, so we had to make sure his siblings didn't see him. We had to take his body away quickly.
Khadija's story is not unusual. Rights groups have criticized the Sudanese Armed Forces, or SAF, for carrying out airstrikes in civilian areas of Darfur. Abdullahi Hassan is a researcher on the Sudan conflict for Amnesty International.
Airstrikes happening in Sudan generally, and particularly in Darfur, attacks carried out by the Sudanese armed forces. We have received information that the Sudanese armed forces have carried out strikes in, for example, in the Nyala city in South Darfur.
Hassan, who is also a Kenyan lawyer and human rights advocate, pointed out that international law requires warring parties to ensure the safety of civilians, even in areas where enemy forces are present. At the start of the war nearly 2 years ago, the SAF was the only side in the conflict that could carry out airstrikes. However, a February 26 Reuters report revealed that satellite images show that the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, have at least three drones at a South Darfur airport. The US has accused the RSF of genocide. Hassan says Amnesty International is investigating recent reports of RSF drone strikes.
In late 2024 and in early 2025 now, we have also received credible allegations whereby the Rapid Support Forces have also started carrying out airstrikes using drones.
The Reuters report says the drones appear to be Chinese-made. Neither the RSF nor SAF responded to requests for comment. For Khadija, the loss of her son is a devastating blow, but her memories of him remain strong.
He loved his siblings very much. He loved me very much. I never separated from him. I was with him 24 hours a day.
As the conflict in Sudan rages on, the civilian cost of indiscriminate airstrikes is becoming more apparent by the day. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, Adre, Chad.
And that's going to wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Karish. ¶¶
We'll be right back.